And welcome back to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we have our interview with Noam Chomsky from April 26th of 2011. We ask him about all sorts of things, from Libya to Pakistan, to his criticism of Arab dictators, to the Tea Party, to some suggestions maybe for changes in rhetoric from the left here in the United States. It's a very interesting interview. He really challenges a lot of our questions and gives us some very interesting answers. So thanks so much to Professor Chomsky for joining us. You're listening to WLUW. Thanks so much to our frequent guest host who's here today with us, Omar, and to the Scientific Map for this music. This is your host, Briscovich. Thanks for listening.
Hello?
Professor Chomsky.
Yeah.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Thanks so much for joining us again. We really appreciate it. It's Jake and Omar on the line, and we'd love to jump right into it.
Okay. All set.
Omar?
Yes. Hello, Professor Chomsky. My first question relates to the Libyan crisis. I think you gave an interview at the end of March, or maybe it was in the beginning of March, with the BBC, where you had said that one of the reasons why we should be opposed to Western intervention is that Libya has this really brutal history with Western intervention, and the people would be bitterly opposed to that in light of the Italian genocide, for instance. However, I think just before the NATO bombing campaign began, many of the rebels in Benghazi and other areas were saying that they wanted Western support. And do you agree that the rebels themselves wanted the West to intervene? And if so, should we still be opposed to Western intervention in Libya?
They did not want Western intervention. In fact, they were pretty straight about that. They don't want Western troops. They said what they said they wanted was air support, first of all, to fend off Gaddafi's forces, but secondly, to help them advance and conquer the country. And there's no doubt that they do want that. Is that enough for us to intervene in a civil war? Well, that we have to decide. I mean, if anybody anywhere, I mean, if you asked people in Bahrain, would they want us to, the majority of the population, would they want the U.S. to intervene to stop the violent repression there? I'm sure they would say yes. But those are decisions that we have to make. I mean, let's take, say, the no-fly zone. The Arab League called for a no-fly zone over Libya, though they immediately protested that the Western powers were going way beyond that. We haven't just imposed a half of a no-fly zone. It's a no-fly zone for Gaddafi's forces, but support for the rebel forces. So that's intervention on one side in civil war. Nevertheless, they did call for a no-fly zone, and that was, plenty of publicity about that in the West. That was the basis for saying, okay, we can go ahead. Well, that's only half of what they called for. The Arab League at about the same time called for a no-fly zone in Gaza. See anything about that? In fact, hasn't been reported in any major U.S. Media outlet. That we don't want.
Related to all the revolutions in the Middle East against all the dictatorships, we thought of this one question. I think we had read in one of the introductions to one of your books that was written by Edward Said, where when he talks about some of the criticisms about your work, he said that Professor Chomsky is very passionate about anything, for instance, about Western intervention or about undemocratic actions taken by Western regimes, but he's not as passionate in criticizing Arab dictatorships. Would you agree with that criticism?
Not at all. In fact, I spend plenty of time on it. But there is an elementary moral principle, which we understand very well with respect to enemies. So let's take an enemy case. I mean, let's take some Iranian dissident today or some Russian dissident in the 1970s. Did we care what they said about U.S. imperialism, U.S. violence? No. We didn't care. What we cared is what they said about their own countries, and for very good reasons. In their own countries, they can affect, and they try at least to affect and change what happens. In fact, many of the Soviet dissidents supported U.S. atrocities. Did anybody care? No. What we cared is what they're saying about their own societies, their own countries, which is their responsibility and which, in principle, they can do something about. Well, you know, that holds even much more strongly for us. We're in relatively free countries. We can really do quite a lot about our own atrocities. So therefore, just by the most elementary of moral principles, that's what we should be concentrating about. I mean, it's easy to rant about someone else's crimes, which you can't do much about. This is a very striking fact about that Western culture cannot understand this elementary moral principle, can't understand it when it's applied to ourselves. We understand it very well when it's applied to others. That's a real striking blind spot.
Another question that we had, moving away from the Middle East and talking about South Asia, for instance, I think recently you had given this interview where you said that the U.S. usually uses Pakistan for its own interests, and that obviously has a detrimental effect on the country itself. But the question that we had was, does anybody in the region have any interest in Pakistan's development, whether it be India or China, which would be its main neighbors, which is one of its main allies, and the other being an enemy for 50 years?
It's like asking whether any state, why not generalize it? Does any state have some kind of altruistic interest in what happens in some other state? States are not moral agents. Now, they work for the interests of concentrated power within them. If it may happen to benefit someone else, it may not, but that's incidental. That's the state behavior. So the answer to your narrow question is no, of course not. But it's just a special case of something much broader. Again, if we were capable of comprehending a very elementary moral principle, which we do understand in the case of others but can't apply to ourselves, we would be interested in the question what we do to Pakistan, not what China does. We can't do anything about what China does to Pakistan. We can do a lot about what we do to Pakistan. Therefore, it should be the focus of our attention. Just as the focus of attention of, some Soviet dissident should have been and was what the Russians are doing in Czechoslovakia, and not what the U.S. is doing in El Salvador, which is 100 times worse. But that's not their concern. We understand it in the case of others. We will not permit ourselves to comprehend elementary moral principles when they apply to ourselves. It's an interesting comment about ourselves. We should learn something from it.
Related to that, recently, there has been a lot of talk ever since Obama became president about how the U.S. has usually only aided Pakistan, for instance, militarily, and that it should really ramp up its economic aid. And in fact, they also announced this economic package. Do you think that that is material in some sense, or is it still really about the military ties that matter and the economic aid is essentially just it's basically just not enough?
Well, it's not even a question. The aid, in some ways, is not the first time that the U.S. has provided economic aid, but it's openly stated that the point of the aid is to try to support and establish a Pakistani regime which will back up U.S. policies. I mean, nobody's concealing that. Again, states are not moral agents. They may do something decent, but it's kind of like a side matter. And incidentally, it's not just the case that the U.S. Supports Pakistan militarily. The Reagan administration, for example, strongly supported the radical Islamization of Pakistan with Saudi money at the time.
Moving to domestic politics in the U.S., we recently read one of your interviews. This is, I think, from the beginning of April, where the question was, is the Tea Party movement a grassroots movement? And you had said that, yes, it is somewhat in some sense, but it's very small and it has this nativist element to it where all the negative things that we see about that group, are highlighted. But the question is, even if it is small, would you agree that it has considerable influence on mainstream Republicans and is radicalizing them? And relatedly, what about the fact that many Republicans are sympathetic towards the Tea Party movement and usually say, well, we think this is a great thing because they're anti-big government, even though that is really not the case and they are focused more on all these negative things such as anti-immigration or being anti-foreign or essentially blaming the federal government for everything?
Well, first of all, if you go back to that interview, you'll notice that I said the Tea Party itself is a relatively small movement, maybe 15% of the population, but that it has considerable sympathy in much broader sectors, and that remains true. It's a small movement, very heavily funded by corporate interests, strongly nativist, or rather comes out of a traditional nativist stream in the United States that nativist, petty bourgeois, anti-government and so on. That's an old strain in American politics, political life, and this is a little more organized and active, but it has considerable outreach, and that remains the case. As far as the general Republican Party is concerned, it's ambivalent. The Republican leadership is pretty ambivalent about it. On the one hand, they're happy to have it as their stormtroops, to attack policies they don't like. On the other hand, they're also afraid of it because it has elements in it which would be quite harmful to the interests of what they really represent, private concentrated capital. So if you read, say, the business press, Bloomberg, Business Week, and so on, representative of a kind of mainstream what's called conservatism. There's plenty of ambivalence there. In fact, you can read it in the front pages of the newspapers. The Republican parties are trying to, the Republican Party leadership is trying to tone down the Tea Party activists because they are pushing for policies which would harm the Republican Party and its main interests. So they're ambivalent. They're influential. So and the party leadership will go along with them when their influence accords with Republican Party, leadership, business leadership interests. So take for example the role of the Tea Party in one of their major achievements so far is to undermine and roll back any form of environmental legislation, right? So they've cut funding for the international agency that monitors the environment. They're trying to cut back the Environmental Protection Agency to prevent it from even monitoring greenhouse gas emissions, trying to cut back its regulatory functions and so on. And the Republican leadership is perfectly happy with that. That's the position of, say, the American Chamber of Commerce, the major business lobby. So if they want to do that, that's fine. On the other hand, if they go beyond that to actually, for example, suppose the Tea Party moves on to try to press for constraints, as they are already talking about, constraints on, say, bailing out financial institutions, which when they crash, well, at that point, The business world isn't going to like that at all. Because remember that the business world does not believe in capitalism and markets. What they want is a powerful state which intervenes in their interest. So when, say Goldman Sachs makes risky transactions and therefore makes a lot of profit, because that's what you get with a risky transaction, but in the full knowledge that sooner or later it's going to lead to a crash of the system, they don't want the principles of capitalism to apply, which means Goldman Sachs would go bankrupt. What they want is to run to the nanny state and ask to be bailed out by the taxpayer, which is exactly what happened. Now, if the Tea Party went on to really introduce capitalist principles, the Republican Party and the business world would clamp down on them very hard.
This is the Logic Consortium here on WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance, in our interview from April of 2011 with Noam Chomsky. We continue with the interview. Thanks so much for listening. As a follow-up to that, Professor, I wanted to ask about some terms that are used in political discussion, like free market, free marketer, neoliberalist. Coming from the left, these are usually pejorative terms. But there are economists on the left who are not at all opposed to using markets. For example, Dean Baker on this program said that he thinks markets are great. We just have to decide when and how to use them. And Amartya Sen, who has written that markets can be an engine of growth and help a society prosper.
I agree with that. Who doubts that?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, instead of using these terms, should the left... should those on the left, when criticizing markets, should they make a distinction?
Who criticizes markets?
It's just a general.
I mean, what?
Well, what I want to say is, should the criticism?
I mean, take what I was just saying a minute ago. I wasn't criticizing markets. I was criticizing the fact that the business world will not tolerate markets.
Right, crony capitalism, as you were saying. I totally agree.
It's not crony capitalism. It's normal state capitalism, which of course has market elements, but insists on a powerful state to support the rich and powerful. So is Dean Baker. In fact, he wrote a book about it. He wrote a book called The Conservative Nanny State, which is exactly about this.
Yeah, we interviewed him about that book on this show.
Pardon? But
we had him on to talk about the book.
What he's talking about is the failure, the refusal of the business world to accept markets. You can argue whether markets would be a good thing or bad. Okay, we could argue that. But the fact is that the reality is that the business world, you know, the Republicans and so on, they don't want markets. They want just what Baker said they want, a conservative nanny state. That is a powerful state that intervenes massively to protect them.
I guess my question is, when saying the term neoliberalist, should there be a distinction between productive markets and non-productive markets? As you said, after the liberalization of capital, after the Bretton Woods fell, there was a huge increase in speculative capital flow, which is quite different than maybe labor markets or product markets, where people can cite complementary interests that are promoted by exchange. Should there be this distinction, I guess, what I'm saying, when the term neoliberalist is used?
Neoliberalism has nothing to do with markets. I mean, something to do with them, but not much. What's called neoliberalism is a very selective use of markets to control the poor and the weak, combined with a strong state intervention in markets to protect the strong. So take the apostle of neoliberalism, Ronald Reagan. Okay, he was the most protectionist president in post-war American history. He doubled protective barriers. He created a state intervention to try to sustain and galvanize the collapsing economy, to try to protect incompetent American management from superior Japanese production. He carried out one of the major bank bailouts. He tripled the debt. You know, that's real neoliberalism. That's what it actually is. On the other hand, it's used as a weapon against the weak. Okay, so it's a version of a mixture of markets, protectionism, powerful state, the deregulation, carefully designed to benefit the extremely powerful and wealthy, and the rest have to look out for themselves. That's entirely separate from an abstract discussion that we might have in some seminar somewhere about whether in principle markets are a good idea. That's a different question. We should separate them.
Omar, do you want to ask the last question?
My final question, Professor Jonsky, relates to one thing that I've noticed that you often do, which is that you cite public opinion polls to support some of your positions. So, for instance, you will cite many public opinion polls saying that the public is overwhelmingly opposed to a war in some region, or that the public is overwhelmingly in favor of having universal health care, or things like that. But is that, how effective is it to cite the polls when the public on many other issues has offensive views? So, for instance, the public will say that, you know, they support Gitmo and they want it to stay, or the public would be overwhelmingly in favor of some war at some point.
I cite those polls, too. I don't know what you're reading, but I'm constantly citing polls that show really outrageous positions. So, for example, you know, half the public thinks that the world was created a few thousand years ago. 25% of Republicans, according to recent polls, and I've cited this, think that Obama may be Antichrist. You know, I think we should cite polls when they're well taken to give us a sense of what public opinion is. We should want to know what public opinion is. There are many cases, including the ones you mentioned, but not the ones you didn't mention, that I've cited. There are many cases where the polls are very revealing about the lack of democracy in the country. That is, they show, take, say, health care. What they show is that public policy is very different from public opinion on issues that would affect concentrations of private power. And that's worth knowing. So sure, we should cite the polls on all issues.
Professor, we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep. Good to talk to you. Yep. Bye.
Thank you. This is the Logic Consortium. You're listening to WLUW Chicago Sound Alliance. And that was our recent interview with Noam Chomsky. Really teaching us so much on issues we need to learn about and expanding our knowledge. So thanks so much to Professor Chomsky, to Omar, and to all you listeners out there. This is the Logic Consortium. You can visit us on our blog, logicconsortium.blogspot.com, or find us on iTunes. Have a great day.